There's a case to be made that if you really want to know what's what in the American economy, you ought to pay more attention to the dollar. So today, we are going to make that case. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 14th of April. Great to have you along as always, everybody. I am proud. Proud, I tell you, to be the front man of a radio program where I can invoke a foreign government's economic policymaking agency, the Monetary Authority of Singapore in this case, and have complete confidence that you are going to keep on listening. Please. Keep listening, all right? Singapore's equivalent of the Fed put a surprise chokehold on its currency this morning. Not ordinarily a thing on which we would spend a whole lot of time, except that it boosted the greenback among other Asian currencies and turned the conversation at our editorial meeting this morning to the dollar and the future of the U.S. economy and what the dollar means for it. Marketplace's Mark Garrison gets us going from New York.
Let's start with where the dollar's been.
The dollar shot up about 20% between mid-2014 and the end of 2015.
That's IHS economist Patrick Newport. In the past couple months, the dollar weakened a bit, though it's still well ahead of where it was before the big climb. Now let's connect that to the larger economy. One way the dollar gets pumped up is foreign investment coming to America.
The reason the dollar is so strong is because we're the leader of the pack. We're doing better than anyone else. If you grade on a curve, the U.S. economy gets an A.
So a strong dollar is a vote of confidence, or at least relative confidence, but that's little comfort for America's exporters, who lose revenue when a beefy dollar makes their stuff more expensive abroad. And a couple months of a weaker dollar generally isn't enough to mean factories start hiring. Execs need longer trends. Steve Murphy is with Capital Economics.
You're not going to see a massive increase because some of these currency swings, they often take some time before manufacturers can really adjust to it.
And in any case, he and other economists aren't betting on the dollar to slide much further anytime soon. Not while there's still turmoil around the world. Steve Hanke is a Johns Hopkins economics professor.
Even big corporations find it very difficult to predict exchange rate movements and insure against those movements.
And that is the little reality trap the U.S. economy finds itself in. The world's envy makes America's currency strong. But that strength makes it harder to get breakout growth. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Reality trap, good phrase, right? We are somewhere in the vague middle of corporate earnings season. Big banks are trickling out. Also, airlines. Delta reported this morning, the first of the big three to do so. And things are really kind of just okay at Delta. Lower than expected revenues. Analysts were moderately pleased. Marketplace's Andy Euler extrapolates to the airline business today writ large.
Delta saved more than $700 million on fuel over last year, but it also paid its employees more. To save money, it's talking about reducing the number of scheduled flights. Michael Boyd runs an aviation consulting firm.
There are 15% fewer airline departures today than there were in 2007. Airlines have ratcheted down capacity.
Delta said it lost money when it had to shut down operations in Brussels because of the terrorist attack. Robert Mann runs an airline industry analysis and consulting firm. He doesn't think events like this affect demand as much as some suspect.
The air travel consumer has a very short memory. If it's not front and center in their wheelhouse, it's not an issue that deters them.
In other words, if you're not heading to Belgium or Brazil in the next few weeks, you're not really thinking about terrorism and Zika. Increasingly, though, airlines are less worried about selling you a seat. Henry Hardevelt is a travel industry analyst in San Francisco.
Buying that underlying ticket, that's almost a break-even effort for the airline.
They're looking for you to buy extra legroom and Wi-Fi, or sign up for that loyalty program, because that's where they stand to make some profit. That goes for majors like Delta and American just as much as budget carriers like Spirit and Frontier.
There are lots of different businesses within the broader airline company that airlines like Delta will be looking at as they figure out how to make money.
And make money by delivering what analysts are calling that living room experience. That is, if your living room has 100 people in it and tray tables. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
And really lousy seating and so much else. Wall Street overall today was much like those Delta earnings, really just okay. Traders bought some, they sold some, and all three major indices just kind of marched in place. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Big data is the thing now, right? It's what advertising is all about, and retail and media and pretty much everything. It's also at Cook Children's Hospital in Fort Worth, Texas, a new tool that doctors there are using to predict and hopefully stop child abuse. From KERA, Lauren Silverman reports.
In 2013, more than 1,500 American children died from abuse and neglect. That's the most recent national info available. Last year in Texas, the Department of Family and Protective Services announced 170 children died. It says Tarrant County, which includes Fort Worth, Texas, has one of the highest rates of abuse in the state. That's where Diane Daly goes to work every day. She heads the Center for Prevention of Child Maltreatment at Cook Children's, a hospital in Fort Worth. Daly's been on a mission to train doctors and nurses to recognize the signs of abuse early, like suspicious bruises or marks. But detecting abuse is really hard. That's where something called predictive analytics could be helpful.
This type of technology has been used to predict where shootings would occur and other types of violent crimes, but no one had ever applied it to a domestic violence like child maltreatment before.
Here's what Daly's team did. First, they collected data on things like poverty, domestic violence, and aggravated assault. Then they crunched the numbers using free predictive software invented at Rutgers University in New Jersey. It's called risk terrain modeling. It spit out a forecast for likely locations of child abuse in Fort Worth.
Amazingly, we were able to capture 98% of the cases that occurred in the future.
So the technology identified specific locations in advance, actual blocks in a neighborhood where cases of abuse would occur. Predictive analytics is a huge market. It's part of a big data industry valued at $27 billion a year. And it's only recently that these tools are being put to work by nonprofits and local governments.
We see some positive examples from around the world, in New Zealand, in Allegheny County in Pennsylvania, in LA County.
UC Berkeley grad student Darian Woods studied how this technology is being used. One success story, Hillsborough County, Florida. After a rash of child homicides there, the government boosted the number of social workers and used predictive analytics to pinpoint the most urgent cases of abuse. Since then, for those under court-ordered protection, the number of child homicides has been zero. Woods warns that could be an anomaly, but that kind of success has caught researchers' attention. Still, even if predictive technology does pan out, there are thorny ethical questions that come with using statistics to judge whether children are safe.
Are we reinforcing racial inequities? Maybe the model might target communities of color more. And so that may lead to more social workers being sent out and more children being taken from homes from those communities.
In Fort Worth, Diane Daly wants to use predictive modeling to target resources, not people.
So what we've decided to do then, knowing where these risk cluster areas are, we've started to work on how can we align prevention services in these areas where the kids need it the most? And how can we bring programs that will address the risk factors that are the most important directly to the place where the children need it the most?
Daly has big plans for this big data experiment. The next step, use the same predictive software to forecast abuse hotspots in the state's largest cities. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
Geography buffs can tell you that the dead geographic center of the 48 contiguous states of this country is a spot in northern Kansas up by the Nebraska border. To get technical, it's 39 degrees 50 minutes north, 98 degrees 35 minutes west. A couple of degrees southeast of there, though, sits a plot of land owned by a woman named Joyce Taylor. It's quiet, remote, usually not a whole lot goes on, but for the past 10 years, Joyce Taylor's had lots of very angry visitors and no real idea why. Kashmir Hill wrote about it for Fusion. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
I have to start by asking you why this woman in Potwin, Kansas, had a toilet dumped in her front yard, why people call and yell at her, and all kinds of terrible things happened to her.
She's had a lot of terrible things happen to her. FBI agents, federal marshals coming to her farm, ambulances coming looking for suicidal veterans.
Oh.
And for the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, she did not know why this was happening. The farm is in the middle of nowhere. It's really remote. The nearest neighbor is a mile away.
And this all has to do with something called IP mapping, right?
It does.
Okay, so explain, please.
So IP refers to Internet Protocol Address, which is basically a number, an address that every single device that connects to the internet needs. So your smartphone has an IP address. Your computer has an IP address. If you have a smart TV that talks to the internet, it has an IP address.
Yeah.
You need this thing in order to be on the internet.
And so have people been mapping IP addresses to this yard? I mean, how does this work?
So there are a lot of people that want to be able to know where in the world an IP address is because they use that IP address to, say, show you ads. But it's hard to do. It's complicated to map IP addresses, and companies do it in a lot of different ways. They used to just actually drive cars around and have cars connect to open Wi-Fi networks and look at what the IP address was and then look at where they were in the world, and then they would know, okay, this IP address is at this place.
And you do some digging, and you find this company called MaxMind, right? Is that the deal?
Yes. There's basically one free open database of IP maps that has a whole bunch of IP addresses along with the latitude and longitude that they're associated with. And so a security technologist crawled through that database for me and found actually thousands of houses that have lots of IP addresses associated with them. But then there was this farm in Kansas that was the number one most popular latitude, longitude. It had over 600 million IP addresses associated with it.
That front yard in Potwin, Kansas.
This front yard in a farm in the middle of nowhere.
Okay, how come?
So the first thing I did was I contacted MaxMind, whose database had pointed us at this house, and I told the co-founder, a man named Thomas Mather, that there were all these problems for this house and what was going on. And he said, when we first started the company, we needed to pick a place in the country that was our default location for the whole U.S., so we chose this IP address in the middle of the country, and they happen to have this really beautiful latitude, longitude. And so they had just chosen this spot, and they had never thought about what it would mean for the people who lived at that spot.
Have they changed their minds now? Are they thinking about what it means for the people in that spot?
Yes. I mean, the company said, we're so sorry. Like, we want to remedy this as quickly as possible. And 2 days after my story came out, they moved the default location for the whole United States to a lake in Kansas, right next to something called Pretty Prairie.
Perfect. And now, have you talked to the poor lady in Potwin, Kansas? Did you let her know that it's fixed?
I have. She was so relieved to finally have this nightmare looking like it's coming to an end. The problem is that, you know, MaxMind doesn't control all the people who use its database. Some of their customers refresh, you know, the information that they have every couple of months. Some do it every couple of days. Some people might not do it for years. Hmm. So this is going to kind of be a ghost in the machine for a while, but it should get better for them.
Kashmir Hill writes for Fusion. It's kind of an amazing story about IP mapping. Check it out. It's on their website. Kashmir, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Coming up.
Until we address segregation, I believe that we're going to continue to be a city of inequities.
Chicago, Illinois, the view from the South Side. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 18 points today, about a 10%, closed at 17,926. The NASDAQ gave up a single point, less than a 10%, finished at 49.45. The S&P 500 pretty much flat, 2,082. Spending on prescription drugs jumped nearly 9% last year. More prescriptions, expensive new drugs, higher prices for old drugs. Thus, Gilead Sciences up 1% today. Pfizer up 0.3%. Valeant down about 1.7% today. Two more big banks reported quarterly profits and lower profits, I might add. Bank of America gained 2.5%. Wells Fargo down 0.4%. Today, a majority of shareholders voted against BP's executive pay plan. Its CEO got a 20% raise despite BP losing $5 billion. The vote, though, is non-binding. Shares down 1.8%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.79%. And you, yes, you, you're still listening, right? You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. First, they were for fun. Then they were for business. Think cool overhead camera shots and maybe Amazon deliveries. Now they are going to be potentially big-time sports. ESPN is teaming up with the International Drone Racing Association to live stream events, the three-day World Drone Racing Championships this coming August for 3 days of that, by the way. It's going to get cut down, though, to an hour-long TV broadcast as well. Think, if you are ESPN, potentially something like NASCAR in the sky. But as Marketplace Sally Herships reports, streaming a race is one thing, turning a brand-new sport into a moneymaker, entirely another. Here's Sally.
It's called drone racing. So there are races, obviously, but there are also competitions of skill.
Think of it like a dog show, right? The dogs have to jump up and then jump down, move around, move up.
Chris Lincheski is CEO of the International Raceway Group. He says drone racing is so new, it makes millennials look old. So advertisers and sponsors will be targeting Generation Z, 11 to 16-year-olds. Think Mountain Dew or Coca-Cola. Lincheski says ESPN's brand will help pull in initial dollars. But long term?
The question is, just because you're racing doesn't necessarily mean anyone's actually going to watch.
When it comes to drone racing, there is a tiny hitch. The FAA won't allow drones to be raced over large crowds, and the roar of the crowd or the rev of an engine can be a big part of energizing viewers. Even the International Drone Racing Association admits watching drones race can be like watching gnats in the middle of a football field.
Watching this thing on YouTube, I thought, you know, this is really cool. But then after about 30 seconds, I thought, okay, what now?
Michael Leeds is a sports economist at Temple University.
The natural inclination to say, well, this is kind of like NASCAR, and you're going to appeal to the same kind of demographic, but it's not.
Leeds says NASCAR fans follow personalities, not robots. But the International Drone Racing Association says that's now. ESPN will bring higher quality production to the event, and viewers will get to know the pilots, like the 15-year-old who won $250,000 last year at the World Drone Prix in Dubai. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Segregation is a loaded word. It brings to mind different times, times that in the law might have been done away with, but which in reality still linger, especially in some of our biggest cities, New York, L.A., also Chicago. That city is the subject of Natalie Moore's new book. It's called The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation. Natalie, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
For those who have not been to Chicago or are perhaps not familiar with it, give us the geography lesson, basically, because you talk about that quite a bit in the book, the geography of Chicago and how it affects the subject matter here.
Yeah, Chicago is a really big city, and I don't mean population-wise. I think that our physical size is a strength, and it's also a deficit or a weakness. because we're so big, we have so many neighborhoods. There are officially 77 on the books. And so on one hand, neighborhood identity is very strong. But on the other hand, you may never go to another part of the city. You may write that off. We have a lot of ethnic enclaves, and we are a diverse city, but we're segregated. And that's unusual compared to a lot of other cities.
There was a moment in your childhood, you relate it in the book, where you where segregation and this idea of separateness came home to you in an instant. You were riding the L on the way to a concert, I guess, up in the city.
Yeah. So even though I grew up in a black neighborhood, my parents, I guess, are what we would call today free range. And my friends and I took public transportation. You know, we were 14 years old. We had been downtown. We were coming back south to go home. And so I'm on the L, and usually white people got off by downtown. Well, these train cars were packed with white people. I don't mean like one white family or, you know, a couple of white people, but standing car only. And then they were headed to the south side. And I was like, where are they going? I know they're not getting off at 79th Street or 87th Street. It was just very baffling to me. And then they all got off at 35th, which is the stop for the old Comiskey Park where the White Sox play. And it just crystallized for me in my 14-year-old head, like, oh, wow, okay. This is segregation.
You talk a lot about housing in this book and how housing is kind of the manifestation and the means, really, of segregation in the city of Chicago, even today.
Yes. And I would say it's the root of segregation in, you know, a lot of American cities. Chicago is a proxy for things that are going on around the country. And so what happened in Chicago, the roots of it go back to the Great Migration. And actually, Chicago is celebrating the 100th anniversary of that.
Which is the movement of large numbers of African American
right.
from south to north.
Right. So we had 500,000 come to Chicago between 1916 and 1970. And just about as soon as they got here, local officials, national officials, banks, governments conspired to keep black people living only in confined spaces. And what does that look like today? You know, what I'm talking about is the past, but we still have banks giving bad loans to places like Chatham, where you have working middle class people who can afford homes.
More expensive loans is what you're talking
right.
about. Yeah. This book is memoir-ish. There's a lot of you, right? I mean, it's your experience both growing up and also now having come back and living there as an adult and a homeowner and a consumer, and the changes you see happening sort of at the margins, but ultimately failing, and your own experience with buying your first condo. First of all, you lost a chunk of money in the housing crash, but also you say people were waiting for those restaurants to come in, for the gentrification to happen, for the cafes and all that to come in, and it never really did.
It didn't. And research from the University of Illinois at Chicago and Harvard University show that black Southside neighborhoods don't gentrify. And gentrification is a loaded term, and you know, it may not be what it's not the end all be all, but there wasn't enough improvement to the neighborhood. There wasn't capital that was coming in. So you had people like me, young professionals who moved in. You still have people on subsidized housing vouchers in the neighborhood. You still have some affordable housing that's there. But just the retail didn't come. And so on one hand, people were expecting maybe some high-end restaurants, but also some basic things like a decent grocery store.
You reserve a special place on your naughty list, I guess, for lack of a better word, for the Chicago Housing Authority and for the politicians of the city of Chicago.
Yes, there are many. I don't think there's political will to change the circumstances. I don't think people are talking about segregation. It's talked in neighborhood development, I think, is talked in broad terms, and we need to start having the conversation about race in this city. And until we address segregation, I believe that we're going to continue to be a city of inequities.
Natalie Moore is the Southside reporter at WBEZ, the public radio station in Chicago. Her new book about the Southside is called The Southside, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation. Natalie, thanks very much.
Thanks, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, Microsoft has been experimenting with artificial intelligence for a while now, as you might have heard. Their most recent effort, a Twitter bot named Tay, went all kinds of sideways when it started sending out racist and sexist tweets. There is a new one, though, seems more benign, fun even. It's called CaptionBot. You can find it at CaptionBot.ai. You plug in a picture and it's going to try to describe for you what's going on in a caption. We gave it a whack, tried it with a couple of pictures of me, got two of them right, one not even close. It thought I was skateboarding, which I haven't done since I was like 12. So anyway, check it out, marketplace.org. It's kind of fun. All righty, we are out of here. The Dow up 18 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ gave up a single point, less than a 10%. The S&P 500 also flat. Golda Arthur, John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow. Bye. Yeah, I don't know what's up with that everybody thing either.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.